Welcome to the Think Fitness Life podcast, where we bring the mind, body, and gym together so you can improve your health, increase performance, and live your best life. For more information, visit thinkfitnesslife.com. Here are your hosts, Matt Gluckman and Eric Menchie.
Life podcast, where we talk everything about mindset, exercise, nutrition with your host Matt, and I got Eric over there in Boston on the mic with us. And today we're going to be going over some research articles. Big topic for Eric, I know. Eric, how often are you reading like PubMed articles or scientific research or textbooks?
Daily.
Yeah.
On the regular.
How much
you got to keep up with it
is you reading new stuff that comes out versus doing your own research and reading old published articles?
More new stuff, because I like to see what's kind of coming out. So a great source I use is Science Daily, which gives articles, but it always links back into research and studies. So you can see what they're saying in the articles, kind of a brief synopsis, and then you can go read the study if you want. So that's usually how I find a lot of my studies and kind of dive into. You're seeing the latest data coming out. Or the other way I hear it is from the news or word by mouth, because people ask me questions about these things.
So a lot of the data, when you look for the actual study after you've read the article in Science Daily or wherever you've read the article, do you find that data? Can you use like Google Scholar or PubMed? Are there any others that are popular to you?
I use PubMed. Usually those are ResearchGate. That's another one I use. But most of them will shuffle back to the initial research article where it's published, if it's free to access or it's part of a journal. But mostly I use a lot of science stuff as PubMed for research finding. That's my go-to kind of search engine.
Okay. And, the reason that we're talking about this today is, we want to get people to, think. That's the first word of our whole brand. But just become a critical thinker in terms of, you take the headline of the article first, then you read the article, then you look at the study before just seeing the headline and taking it all as matter of fact. And I think in the fast-paced world that we live in, it's really easy to get into the category of scroll. I see a bunch of headlines. Okay, I see a headline that applies to me, like fact, and then keep scroll, rather than clicking and diving into the actual article. So,
and that's the issue with nowadays, with this life of 10, 15 seconds on whether it's TikTok, Instagram, or whatever outlet you use of information. People don't take the time to actually stop and read and look. They just want to know, okay, what's the quick bit of information? Problem is, a lot of these studies, there's a lot of things going on. There's multiple levels of the studies that people don't understand. And sometimes, not all the times, because science is good, we like science, but if it is pushing to a certain direction or a certain outcome, people might have questions on it. You have to really read the data and see what the numbers are providing. And not just reading like an excerpt that was taken out of the study, but taken out of context, it's used in a completely different manner and can kind of skew the way people view things. And it's been done years and years over time. It's been done through marketing industry. So big companies and corporations that want to fund their thing, they're going to push their own data and their own findings. That's a big thing. So a lot of times when it comes to research, like we will dive into, you have to really find out, is it legit? And what's kind of behind this research? So we're not looking at just key marketing thing. And we're in times now where, little scary times, right? Where we're in these times where people want to know science. But I think science, in my opinion, is getting a little bit kind of pushed to the side because agendas want to be pushed further. So it's like, okay, we really need to take a step back and not get marketed certain things and start looking at the actual data and the science coming out. And then we are starting to do that as a society, especially with things like sugar and fats years ago, that used to be touted as fats were bad, sugars weren't the problem. Finally, it's starting to flip. We're starting to see this push for less sugar, less processed food to cut down and to cut down on healthcare spending and healthcare issues in the future.
Yeah, I think a big one, kind of cycling back to kind of the first thing you're talking about, but from science to article, is correlation doesn't always mean causation. And you'll see a lot of these studies that come out that observed a correlation, and then all these articles written about it that the wording is in a causation manner. And they reference a study that is just observing a correlation. So I think that's probably the most common practice, because that's like how you get someone's attention to click on something. You know, you're not going to click on something that says like, hey, there might be a connection here. I mean, unless you're someone who, you know, is very already methodical, then, you know, you already have a good head on your shoulders. That's great. I want people to be more like that. But I think the way that things have structured is it's a competitive space. People want to get you to click on their articles. They want you to read about the study that's associated with their press group or whoever's basically marketing it. So I think a good example. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying that's huge, right? The promoting of things, you know, food, certain things, or kind of pushing data to the side that we know exists, but it's not going to benefit a company from making money, that it's kind of like put away. And you have a great example of that.
Yeah. This is just a funny, you know, because it's after the fact. This thing's written more recently, but it goes over dives into the history of tobacco and the cigarette companies from the 30s and 50s, and are the articles that would say doctors advise healthy cigarette brands. And it has clips from the newspaper. It says 113,000 doctors from coast to coast were asked. Family doctor, surgeons, nose and throat specialists, doctors in every branch of medicine were asked, what cigarettes do you smoke? And the answers came in by the thousands. Actual statements from doctors themselves. Figures were checked and rechecked. The results? Camel. So more doctors smoke Camel cigarettes than any other cigarettes. Let's see. After all, doctors
imagine
are humans
that. Imagine
too.
That.
They smoke for their pleasure. The
pushing
taste.
Cigarettes.
It's pretty amazing.
But that was the trends, right? So these big companies, these cigarette companies, and they've done it to an extent, but up until like the, I think it was like the mid, late 90s, that they really got shut down, right? You can't see cigarette ads on TV. You really can't see them on billboards anymore. I'm not even sure if they can put them in magazines anymore, because they know the issue with them. But think about it, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, that was what doctors said. Imagine that. And now, you know, when you hit the 60s, 70s, 80s, they start realizing, well, there's a correlation here. Cancers, disease, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, you name it. That's where, and we can see that's where marketing can really trick people. Now, whether they knew back then, because they had the data or science, I don't know, right? Probably I would say they probably had an inclination that smoking cigarettes were bad, because the 30s, 40s, 50s, I know people think it's a long time ago, but people still had a pretty good gist of what was healthy and what wasn't, right? We still had the aerobic doctrine come out by Dr. Kenneth Cooper, right? You know, got to do aerobics, got to stay healthy, all that stuff. And we're also seeing trends of physical activity starting coming out, being healthier. So they had to have known that smoking cigarettes wasn't beneficial for you, but yet they push it anyways.
Yeah. You know, there's a piece of that is a layer of it for sure. Because at the time, it was considered an anti-stress remedy. And nobody had seen and foreseen the problems until, you know, 30, 40 years later. But, you know, this is also an example of the marketing side of things. If you read some of these ads, some of them just say about being that they're them being less irritating. And it just says like 20,000 physicians say that Lucky cigarettes are less irritating. And it doesn't really ever talk about like the science behind what's the difference between a fresh and an irritating cigarette. Like it really matters anyway. And then there are some other ones that'll just say, you know, if you've been smoking and it stings or burns your throat, switch to Camels, because the stinging is a peppery dust left in the tobacco by inefficient cleaning methods that makes you cough. So give your throat a vacation, switch to Camels for just one day, then leave them if you can. It's just, I don't know, it's just kind of funny. Like, tell them to switch to Cools and they'll be all right. Doctors, lawyers, merchants, like the marketing is already about explaining how the people who are higher up in the society, because, you know, you got to remember 30s and 40s and 50s, there was definitely a social hierarchy where you went to the doctor and you trusted everything they said. You went to their lawyer and you were, you know, putty in their hands to do everything for you. And so just talking about how they pick the cigarettes of that brand, and they're just trying to do brand marketing and get you to buy that specific brand of cigarettes. So zooming out, yeah, there is that whole side of the health issues of cigarettes in general, but then zooming in, you get the whole marketing spin on the science at the time, and now it's Chesterfield versus Dunhill versus Cool versus Camel versus Viscery versus Lucky. So you get this, you get an exponential increase to the misinformation and bad agendas that are out there that are causing confusion in the public by this little dichotomy between the science and marketing.
And that is always going to be a problem. And we still see it to this day. Only recently, I mean, more like, where are we at, 5-7 years ago right now, the sugar industry came under attack. And it's been out for a while.
Probably about 2015, maybe 2012.
Yes, I think it was 16. They dug through. Same thing. These, and part of getting into research and marketing is companies and corporations need to make money. So how are they going to do that? They're going to make it seem like their product, whether good or bad, is beneficial, and they want you to buy it. So they're going to hide information, or they're going to throw it away or push it away. And that's a big issue when it comes to marketing and research. As you found out with the sugar cover-up, researchers at Harvard were paid back in the day over $50,000. And that's back in the day, to basically shift the blame of studies finding that sugar was bad and led to heart disease and cardiovascular disease to saturated fat. And what that did is it shifted everything. People were terrified of fat. And I'm sure you remember growing up in the 90s, fat was a bad thing. Low fat, no fat, like, oh, you got to limit cholesterol. I remember my parents even worried about that. And now we've kind of gotten out of that and we're flipping it and be like, no, it actually, fat's not the problem. Certain kinds of it, yes, but it's sugar. And now that industry is really taking a hit. But what does that do? It's going to fight back no matter what. It's going to market their things in different ways. Coca-Cola now has this zero sugar Coke, but probably tastes the exact same. So they claim, okay, tell me what's in it to make it taste the exact same. These companies aren't going to just roll over and be like, all right, we're not going to make money. They're still going to figure out how to make their money on these products by bad marketing. And people still are not aware of the issues with marketing and what research can do in that realm.
And we're just trying to get people to be aware of it. That's mm-hmm. all. Because it's always going to be out there. Just about making you a smart, what's the word I'm looking for? A smart learner. And just being able to question things and be open-minded, but be skeptical at the same time. I think it's really important. I mean, you made a good point about the sugars and fats. Because I remember for the longest time, my mom would make sure she cuts the fat off of everything I ate. And now it's like come full circle where I'm eating the fat. I make sure I eat the skin. I'm eating maybe even some of the cartilage. And if I'm eating like chicken breast or even red meat, I don't cut the fat off. I mean, there's a lot of benefits. They have shown through the carnivore diet studies that when you eat an animal nose to tail, that there's a lot of compounds that you need from like the liver, from the fat, from the cells, or the cartilage that coexist with the proteins. But if you're just eating just straight lean meat protein, then there are some compounds in there that can build up over time and be problematic to the system.
But in fairness, and people don't know. People don't. Like, our parents really didn't know. They weren't in this field. So they were going by what the food pyramid said, what doctors said back then. And no offense to some doctors, they were lied to. And I feel like people are generally lied to every time they step into a supermarket, because they are sold on certain things that they think are maybe beneficial but not bad. But the underlying research does not support that, right? So you still have products loaded with high fructose corn syrup, all this crap that these companies know is bad, but there doesn't matter, because if we can deceive them and make it seem like it's healthier by putting like low caloric food on it or all this jazz, low fat, low sugar, but it still has these processed compounds in it, they're just tricking you into basically doing the same behavior patterns over and over again. And it's not beneficial for anyone, as we've seen with increase of disease rates and all-cause mortalities go up a lot from dietary behavior and intake of poor food choices.
And I don't want to go too far into the side of saying that they're lying, because that's a whole episode in and of itself for a podcast, you know, like the whole lie is not really down that road, aiming for understanding, I think, is the best route to go. So in my eyes, it's like, I mean, yeah, like a lie has, we can sit here and argue definitions or go back and forth and explain different definitions, but it's different agendas and it's different regulations that get pulled back and pulled back and pulled back and pulled back and pulled back. And yeah, they become very misleading. And I think in terms of lies, I would have to say it's more about that's perspective. Mm-hmm. That's like us looking back. That's and knowing something today and looking back and saying that was a lie. When at that time, they didn't necessarily think it was a lie. They just were blurring the lines a little bit and were being truthful, but they didn't realize at how much that little discrepancy in their transparency would create problems later on. Like, for example, going back to the 30s and 50s of cigarettes, we can come sooner. So 30s, 50s, go to the 70s, and you had articles that would come out about sugar and it keeping your energy up but your appetite down. And it's like they're clearly blurring the lines there, because, you know, sugar can be the willpower you need to undereat. Like, really? Like, that's not going to be beneficial. That's not the be-all, end-all, because we've proven that high-sugar diets are going to actually lead to metabolic dysfunction, weight gain, and more cardiovascular risky events. So it wasn't wrong, but it was purposefully misleading to get you to buy more sugar, to get the sugar industry to be more profitable, because a lot of the FDA and USDA was backed by Coca-Cola and still is. And they don't want anything to come out that says sugar's bad. They want things to come out that promote people to buy things with sugar in it. So I don't want to go to the side of calling them liars, because I think we're smarter than that. We know that it's not just evil people behind a calculator, like figuring out how to get more profits. Although there are people out there like that as well. They're kind of ruining it for the rest of science out there. But it is people who take the science or who fund for a specific science to be studied and then blur the results to get an agenda pushed. And I think that's where we can help people pull the wool out from their eyes to really see the truth behind a study. And, you know, at the end of this podcast, I want people to understand how to read good articles and how to define that. So, you know, we talked about this earlier.
Not all research is bad, right? I don't think all research articles are bad at all, but you have to... We'll get to take it. You have to analyze research, you can read things all day, just blurbs or headlines, but you really have to kind of be diligent in reading the article and kind of seeing what it's putting out there, right? Sometimes a lot of people just read headlines and they shoot it back, and I'm like, well, did you read the whole thing? And they read the study, and just because there's a one-line grabber, cliffhanger, that doesn't necessarily always mean that the article ends up being like that. I've read plenty where it's at the end it says
no, but that's the whole. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, at the end, there's just like, oh, there's yeah, we're coming. These conclusions are coming out, but we still need more research to be done. So it's like, oh, okay, like that's great. Like, but I think what you're gonna say is like that's what the problem is. People, these articles are saying that without reading it. It's like, well, that's it, and there's no real in-depth review or look at what is actually coming out of these studies.
And that's just the difference of science versus marketing is science is the scientific approach. Doing a studies, digging further, asking questions, examining limitations, not just here's the fact that I'm looking for, let me go out and find data that supports my fact, or oh my gosh, I just found a little correlation. Let me make this article that gets people to click on it and read it and just completely mislead them to the actual facts. And that's why I don't want to get into the side of labeling them as lying, because there's so many agendas out there. There's people who just want to feed their family and just want to do good research and get people to click on it. But I think coming back to what our goal is for the end of this episode is to get people to understand data and funding. So when you look at an article, if it has the study linked at the bottom, before you even read the article, you'll know how to click on that link and see if it's a good study, even worth reading the article. Because if the study is just a theoretical study, or it has like a sample size of like 5 people, or it's just purely analytical data over a 2-hour period, then you already know that the article that was written on it is baseless. But if you click on that link at the bottom of that article and you find something with a large sample size and a good strength in their findings, so they found a large correlation across multiple population bases or multiple locations, then it's starting to have more traction. If you start to see more empirical data versus purely analytical, then now you've seen that it's beyond just that one study, and now it's including some other data and other information from past studies. And then epidemiological study versus not was a great point by you, if you want to go ahead and explain that one.
Recently, with a lot of documentaries and research, is what people have to be kind of aware of is, and they're still valid studies, but epidemiological studies is just analysis of distribution of like, okay, who, what, when, where, and your patterns. And a lot of times they use it for health and disease. So sometimes the issues with epidemiological studies is they're not, I would say they can be valid, but they're not taking all factors into consideration. So they might ask, okay, so you're going to become part of the study. We're going to track you for 5 years of your life, but you're going to write down every 3 months what you ate and what you can remember, what you did, what you ate, and that's it. And then you'll come in and we'll test some levels or whatever you want to test. We don't know what that person does outside of what they're writing down on the paper, right? So we're just getting kind of mass groups of their normal life. So you, with those, you can have an unhealthy user bias or a healthy user bias, right? So you can have people that are really healthy that go through this epidemiological study and they can alter the data. But on the other side, if you have an unhealthy bias, they can alter the data in the other way. So I always tell people you have to be very careful when it comes to epidemiological studies, because there can be some avenues of foolproofness. Like it's hard. There's too many different variables that aren't at play it's not like you've locked someone in a room or a lab and you've studied them for 5 years straight and you've controlled every aspect of that person's life. Now, some epidemiological studies might not even ask if that person smokes, and they're studying for cardiovascular disease. So how are you going to tell me that if you didn't even ask them if they smoked and you said something correlates with increased cardiovascular disease and they didn't ask certain questions? It's like, well, okay, I can see what you concluded, but are we really kind of doing this? So that's my kind of big thing with epidemiological studies. And they've been used a lot in recent times to kind of try to prove, you know, causation and correlations with, you know, two things and diseases and cancers and all that jazz. So for the listeners is, you know, they can still be accurate, but you have to take them with a grain of salt. You have to really see, okay, was this an epidemiological study, and read through it. Okay, there could be outliers. And then from there, you can go look at studies that might have a healthy user bias versus an unhealthy user bias. And you can see where the numbers can change. I would like to say you kind of, it's not fair, because if you have a healthy user bias, means everyone's doing everything, how they're working out, their diet is very on point, they're not eating any processed foods, those numbers can skew actual data where we know that most people don't live in a healthy user bias. Then once you get into an unhealthy user bias, it can take something and basically say, oh, because someone ate eggs every day, that it could increase their cholesterol. But it also might not say that they smoke or drank or ate McDonald's every day with those eggs. So a little bit to be cautious of those studies. Like Matt said, empirical, which means there's extensive data on it. That's always a more solid approach, because the more data points you have on something, the more you can understand it. Some studies come up and they might be one or two studies of their own and the first of their kind, and that's more analytical. And once you get into that, it's sort of like, okay, we might need to do a little more research. But once you get into empirical meta studies and data analysis where we have 30, 40, 50 years of studies coming out, it's like, okay, we can start making a little more conclusions.
Let's use an example. Let's talk about that metabolism study. So an article was written recently about a meta study, so encompassing over 60, 70 authors over, where was it here? I don't want to misquote. Six labs collected over 40 years, 80 co-authors. The article that came out said, what we think we know about metabolism may be wrong. Okay? I think that's a great example of a quality headline. Clearly, they're trying to grab you with attention, but clearly they're not trying to make any definitive or give any definitive solutions or answers right away. They want you to click and further read. They talk about the findings. They discuss the articles, and then there's a link to see the document that was written that about the meta study. So in that document, you can click on go further and find more of the authors, find more of the directed studies, and dig even further. So this wins in a couple categories, but it also doesn't look good in some other categories, and we're going to go ahead and break it down. In terms of the sample size and the strength of findings, that's a plus. That's a check right there, thumbs up. Empirical versus analytical, it's a meta study, so it's another thumbs up. Epidemiological versus not. Most of the studies were not. And the funding, I didn't have any clear single layered funding that came from a group of people that were trying to get you to misbelieve in metabolism. So clearly there's a lot of weight to this published article. And all they're really trying to say is that we previously thought that your metabolism would decline every year after you're done puberty. So if like 25 on, your metabolism just slows down. But what it's determined is that you have three major periods of your metabolism. From age 1 to 20, your metabolism's growing. From age 20 to 60, your metabolism holds steady. And at 60, your metabolism declines at about 0.7% a year. The importance behind then taking this information and processing it is, okay, this is a meta study. It has a large population base and large strength in findings. Then there's clearly some takeaways here. And a big takeaway coming from my perspective is that too often do people blame their metabolism or blame their body, blame their genetics, blame their biology for their weight gain or their lack of weight loss. And what we're trying to show here and what the studies are trying to show here is that that's false, is that there's something else to look at, is that if your metabolism across the board should hold steady between 20 and 60 and you're having issues with weight gain or not being able to lose weight, whatever it may be, then clearly you need to look at another category. You need to look at the pillar of your activity levels and your exercise. You need to maybe do a deep dive into what your diet entails and the quality and the sourcing. And you need to maybe look at your gut health and possibly have leaky gut that's causing you to have weight gain. But you can't just blame your metabolism, because you should have the ability to get your metabolism functioning appropriately. So wouldn't you agree that that's a good example?
I think this one's
there?
Yeah. And this is, I say this, it's a tricky art. This is a tricky research, right? Because a lot goes into metabolism. I think people need to understand that first. You know, metabolism, like we discussed prior to this, it's not just your ability to burn food. Your body is running metabolism through all cells of your body, throughout wake, sleep, you name it. Like right now, there's all sort of processes going on. Now, I would, from my perspective, it looks like this is looking at more metabolism as if your overall energy expenditure daily, so your basal metabolic rate. And that's not really fluctuating too much. But on the flip side, it's saying to people is that your metabolism doesn't really not change. So it's not an excuse for people to be like, oh, my metabolism doesn't change, I'm good. Right? There's more factors that play a role into it, like you were saying. So I think now that this opens this door, it now opens up another conversation saying, well, people shouldn't just assume that their metabolism is going to slow down at 30. Like, what are they doing to cause their metabolism to possibly be altered a little bit? So whether slow down or speed up. And it did mention in the article, you know, about having muscle mass and more metabolic tissue, that the decrease of that as we age, that is a possibility to lead to a decline in metabolic rate. So you're declining your metabolism. So great article, new research. It's going to kind of change how we kind of view what's going on with our environment, with our diet choices, with how we live our life. And got to kind of think with some of this, are some of these people active, inactive? We don't know. We'll find out once we really read the full study, but they might not ever say what their user bias was. That's fine, but it gives a total different perspective of kind of how we can kind of look at research. It was a great example of that, saying, okay, this is new coming out, and they say this will lead to further research on this topic and why that is occurring, right? So we've kind of figured out right now there's something going on, but we haven't figured out that why yet. We kind of have a gist, right? So 1 through 20, you're really growing. Like you're becoming an adult. And at some point, if you do that and it stops, your metabolism should sort of plateau, because organisms, we need to survive, right? And then as it keeps going, at some point, we do start to slow down as our processes slow down as we age. But as we've known, it has always been because we age. And what now science is starting to say now, that might not be the case. We might be doing it because of our lifestyle choices.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really important part of just looking at research articles in general, is Eric's kind of walking through the steps mentally of looking at the other variables, like some of the other contributing factors that are playing into it, and then where to take the future research, where to look at things next. And I think that's a great way to not only get the results, or get the the chunk of data that you're looking for from this article that's going to apply to your life, but then it's also going to help you to ask the questions so that you know how to continue looking for information referencing what you're specifically looking for. Because it's like, kind of more specifically, it's like, well, how does that affect someone who's 40 who already had two kids? And how does that affect someone who had a knee injury and went from biking to swimming twice a week or something like that? So now you can get more specific. There's not going to be specific articles out there for everyone's specific scenario, but if you can start to piecewise the data out there from published studies that are reputable, then you can basically come together with a collection of information that's going to be most applicable to your lifestyle, your habits, your behaviors, and your fitness journey. So we have one more that we want to go into and break down: the aging and caloric restriction. You want to go ahead and talk about this one a little bit?
This one is picked it because it's very similar to the one we just discussed, where we're still talking metabolism, but we're just going to see how these studies kind of differ, and one can get a little bit more in depth and kind of lead you into more of a direction, right? So a lot of research initially, like the first one we mentioned, will just kind of be of a broad spectrum, but this one's going to kind of really dive in, and we won't go read the whole thing, but basically saying, okay, as we age, you know, there are metabolic processes that change, right? Things get altered. And that's, maybe I shouldn't say as we age, but that's as we go through life with certain lifestyles, things change. We know that we can change our metabolism through
genetic expression.
Yep, through exercises, through eating, through nutrients, through minerals and vitamins we intake. That all plays a role into how our metabolism functions, because it all functions at a cellular level. And this is saying that at certain points in your life, if you caloric restrict, it delays the onset of age-related diseases. So that can be huge. And this article dives a lot more into how basically our metabolism functions and how certain hormones play a role in growth and non-growth and cyclical movements of the body, right? The body needs to grow. It needs to turn up protein synthesis and turnover. And at the same time, it needs to go down and have that not always an on switch and kind of relax so we can clear cells and have autophagy and all of that. And our bodies basically run off of enzymes, and enzyme speed increase and decrease, but based on our internal environment and our external environment or our lifestyles. And it just shows how a study like this will dive more into the exact sciences of what things are turning on and off.
Specifics.
Yes. It's, in layman's terms, let's, for the people listening, let's just put it like this, because a lot of people won't get, if you read this, you'll be very confused with the acronyms they're using, the enzymes. But we'll put it like this. It's almost as if you walk in your house.
Or you'll just be so bored that you won't want to read it.
Right. And that's what sometimes makes
this is so in depth. It's so,
And that's the stuff that those research we don't see a lot of in the mainstream media, because it's, or, you know, these higher end posts, because it's not really pushing a solid ending. It's just saying, hey, we see this, we know what happens with this when we restrict calories. It changes metabolism. And why I also picked it kind of goes along with the other one, and it kind of, I wouldn't say contradict, but it kind of shows how it can be a little bit different, right? So we have one that's saying, oh, through your 20s, 30s, 40s, it very much stays the same. But this one says, well, if you do certain things to your metabolism or your body, you can now change it and alter it. So one's kind of basically, to me, right, kind of comes off, says, hey, this is the end all be all. This is what it is. The other one says, well, it's like maybe I want to open up the garage door on the far end of the garage rather than the close one. Or do I want to turn the heat on versus the AC on when it's certain temperatures outside? And that's what this second article is really saying is when it's warm outside and I want to cool down, I need to turn the AC on. I don't need to just have it stagnant or turn the heat up a little bit more. So we're always regulating in an internal environment through our body. And I think that's where for metabolisms, what people need to understand is it's not just this one thing. It's not one switch that flicks on and go, hey, let's increase and decrease it. It's like thousands of switches upregulating and downregulating daily as we're going through this life. So great article, kind of goes to show caloric restriction can delay that age process. Now, on the contrary side, right, you can't do that forever because the body's built for survival. So when people might read that, be like, oh, aging and caloric restriction, and they see an outcome that says it can decrease the aging process, right, and has a role in longevity. I agree with that, but it's in moderation. You can't restrict calories every day of your life because then your body just thinks it's going to be dying and it's literally going to shut down or it's going to regulate down to new levels. So there's always this balance of back and forth, right? That's why exercise is so beneficial because you put yourself outside of homeostasis, outside of these realms, your body's like, oh, F, I have to figure out what's going on and I have to adapt to this. And then it comes back down and it regulates itself back and forth. The same thing happens with eating, whether you're fasting, not fasting, or eating certain foods, whether you're eating vegetables and good quality proteins, or are you eating Kraft mac and cheese and processed meats, right? That all turns on different signals. And that's the end part of research, especially on the nutrition side, is we need to make sure that people are getting the correct information. And that's what we're most concerned about, is the correct information so they can live a full, healthy, and long life that they want without having these ailments, right? There's no sense of living a long life, but the last 30 to 40 years are poor quality because people in industries were misleading with some of their information to make money.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely a benefit to needing to have some sort of variance in your diet. Because like Menchie said, what the study is referencing is when you just eat at 1,000 calories a day, well, guess what? Your body's not going to be burning 2,000 calories a day. If you keep consuming 1,000 calories a day, your body will adjust the level that it's burning. So in a way, it applying to the way studies are done and the way articles are written is there's not like a blanket diet that works for everybody. And there's not a blanket study that's going to tell you how to live your life and how to eat so that you are at your perfect weight all the time. It is a combination of things. And that's why the best thing we can do is inform and educate and teach people how to be good learners and how to look for good research and make appropriate decisions based off of good research rather than making whimsical, erratic behavior changes based on headline articles. Or headlines of articles. And that's where there's a big difference between the science versus the marketing of things. And unfortunately, not all science is good marketing and not all marketing is good science. You just have to take everything with a grain of salt and be very skeptical, but also be open-minded. The idea behind reading something is to learn something and take something away from it. So don't just throw all the baby out with the bathwater. See what little tidbit of gold information that you can take out of something or away from a study that they did really well, and you know, hold reservations for things that are yet to be determined.
Another thing, reading research and articles like that, sometimes they word them very tricky, so you might not be able to completely understand them. It's just sometimes their language they write in that, depending on the study, I'm not saying they're all like that, but they can get very tricky to understand. So if that's the case, right? If you then you always, like, you would go to a doctor if you had an ailment, reach out to a professional or someone who is in that field that can possibly understand or explain that to you, right? I mean, how many times have you had clients be like, hey, I saw this on the news, but I don't really understand the study? or I really didn't read the study. And then you come back and read the study and you're like, well, it really didn't push enough to have that outcome. They were just kind of saying that. And there's a lot over the years of what I've read and back and forth, or there's just slight nuances in the study, like itself, the study design, that just leaves these gray areas and loopholes for contingencies of what could happen. So that's another thing to just be aware when you're reading research. If you've come across one, reach out to someone who can read it. Reach out to us. We will steer you in the right direction.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely an important part to be stated that's kind of what we're here to do, and that's what we do. And, you know, after all this talk about nutrition and recommendations, we've looked over so much research that we know that what's out there and that's been proven in the data. And if you, all the research out there has shown that you can't just cut calories to lose weight. Your body will adjust its metabolism accordingly and will stop burning as much energy. And you can't just say, I'm going to just eat fats all the time and that's how I'm going to lose weight. That would be the mindset of, I'm just going to go purely keto. It doesn't work that way. It is about being able to learn to read good research articles and inform yourself of the best decision for you and your state and your perceived goal and outcome for your situation, because everyone's different. But if you're looking to be nudged in the right direction, or if you want to download our how-to guide of three simple steps to analyze good research articles, just email thinkfitnesslife@gmail.com with the heading science or marketing, and we'll send you that guide right away. And yeah, just keep on educating yourself, keep thinking, and keep putting fitness in your
life. If you're ready to make steps towards improving your health or increasing your performance, book a free 30-minute call today by visiting thinkfitnesslife.com.